The Missing Witches Project is entirely listener supported, and listener, we want you to join us. Do you want to be part of a community that helps make public research into marginalized ideas? Do you want to join in interviews with all these magical people and meet other anti-racist, trans-inclusive, neuroqueer feminist practitioners of different kinds from all over the world in our monthly circles? Or are you maybe just down to send a little money magic towards these stories and ideas and the causes we support? Anyway, either way, check out missingwitches.com to learn more about us. And please know, we've been missing you. And one last thing before we start. The stories we tell require a general content warning. It's just a fact of this terrain of interrogating what is missing. We promise to hold those moments with care.
You aren't being a proper woman, therefore you must be a witch.
Be a witch. Be a witch. Be a witch. Be a witch. Be a witch.
You must be a witch.
I'm sending you my trembliness as we get started here. I'm excited about every interview we get to do. Every person that I've gotten to meet through this podcast has like exploded my brain. And that's why we started doing it, was to research these people whose ideas we were missing and longing for. It's a feminist history of ideas project, and that's always been the passion and driving force. But to get to come close to people that feel like our icons and ancestors and hear stories of what real life was like for people whose work really moved you is particularly trembly, let's say. So that's where I'm at today as we welcome these members of the Leonora Carrington Foundation and family. Welcome. Would you take a moment to introduce yourselves and introduce yourselves in that, let's say, the most widest of definitions? Who are you today and how are you and what brings you to this moment with us? Do you want to start, Daniel, since you and I were the ones that first found each other?
Sure. So my name's Dan or Daniel or Danny. I helped found and also helped run the foundation for Leonora Carrington, who is my grandmother and was a surrealist artist, writer, and intellectual in many mediums and in many different ways. I've been very fortunate to be able to share her story and try to continue her legacy, which is very important to us. And of course, my father's here with us, who's part of the foundation and also represents the estate. So a lot of the projects that have been coming out and a lot of the resurgence has a little bit to do with, unfortunately, our marketing skills, but obviously, mostly, I'd like to thank all of Leonora's amazing, incredible work.
Well, you know, I was always very upset with books that were written about Leonora. So when I had a conversation with Dan and my wife, I finally decided that I was going to write a book, a memoir, of Leonora. And it was published in England, which was a pleasant surprise because bit by bit, they're recognizing that she exists at all. It's called The Invisible Painting, So that would be one of the things that we have been organizing either personally or collectively. Now there's an exhibition in different places in Europe, There's going to be one in Denmark, there's going to be one in Spain. Do you know where the other? It's a Biennale, for example, in Italy, and they took the name of the Milk of Dreams, which was a title that I gave to a notebook that was given to me about stories, that Leonora used to read to us during our infancy, and they were written by her, and they were illustrated by her. Mm. So it's also another one of the projects. And then there was another one called The Dark Book. And The Dark Book is full of Leonora's illustrations and my texts. But Danny, for example, collaborated with a very important exhibition in Mexico City, in the what they call the National Library, La Biblioteca Nacional. And there we did something that I thought was quite interesting because we mixed all sorts of things, you know, like sculptures and, well, posters that had to do with Leonora's work, paintings and so on. No, we didn't take the paintings there because it was a bit risky, but that's how we more or less organized things.
I wondered, I read recently that she really believed in, and you can tell me if this is true, because I know there's a lot of stuff that gets written that's not, but that she really believed in living a surrealist life, not in performing it to try to be popular, but that it was part of life. And I wonder if that was true and what that was like to live as part of your family.
Well, you live as best you can, first of all. But then I don't think that Leonora went for a surrealist life or not. No, you have to understand that her creation, no, had to do, first of all, with a very personal, I don't know, approach to surrealism. It was not at all what Breton wanted as a kind of indicator or as a thing to follow. She was not a follower. She was a doer. So she did things, no? But then her life, for me, her life was as a mother and as a friend. I don't know if she was surrealist in those ways. I doubt it. To be a mother, you have to be a mother, you have to be a mother, you have to be a mother. Like Gertrude Stein would say, a rose is a rose is a rose.
Yeah, I wondered when I read that, because it seemed like I was sort of framing her as somebody who was always painting mustard on her feet her whole life or something. And I was like, well, she was a mom. Like the other things I've read about her was her saying, you know, I painted with a child in my arms. So I wondered about that. These different ways of framing, in particular women artists, as we're like, oh, we're rediscovering her. And so now let's frame her in this one way and this other way. I think it's so important that there's people like you who are like, this is a person. This is a person who lived to make art, who lived to be a parent. I don't know. I would love to hear more of your memories of just what she was like.
Well, she wasn't combative, though. I would say that okay. there is a beauty to that, right? Like there are
totally.
Things that made her who she was, whether that's, you know, people want to categorize that as surrealist or not, you know, she definitely would stand up for herself. And as a woman in Mexico, when at the time that she was there, and unfortunately to this day, that is something that shocked many Mexicans. You know, she was incredibly strong. She was part of the feminist movement in Mexico, and she was fiercely protective. If anybody tried to mess with her kids, you know, they would end up getting sort of whatever concoction she would come up with, whether that ended up being the carcass of a pig very well dressed outside of the office of somebody who had, you know, been mean to one of her kids, or going after some other kids that had paddled my father because they were in some sort of fraternity or something. So she went after them with an umbrella, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, a dangerous umbrella.
Yeah. A dangerous umbrella.
Very pointed. Umbrella. Danny's right. I mean, he's speaking about a person that was very straightforward. No? But go ahead, Danny, go ahead.
Well, then I was also going to say, and what happened if you ended up getting bitten or scratched by one of the animals and you went to try to complain? And the same thing happened to me. This would happen to him with Leo, and then it would happen to me with him. And the answer would say, well, what did you do to the animal? And that respect and love for nature and every single living thing around us, including plants, that sort of understanding of equality, taking off that sort of ego of humankind and thinking that they're so great, you know, and truly being able to value and understand these different beings is probably one of the greatest things that I got from her, you know, that,
Yeah, I have an anecdote that we were living in Cuernavaca, which is a small little town about an hour or so from Mexico City. And we had a guest there. And the guest was horrified because they suddenly discovered that there's a scorpion running on the floor, no? And the guy got up and he was on the point of trying to kill the scorpion. And we both held the guy and we said, in this house, you don't kill scorpions. We always put them in the garden where they can do their business. And that was it. No, but the guy was furious. No?
Oh, man. I love her so much. I love the story so much. She reminds me so much of my own grandmother. I mean, you mentioned before we started recording, I said, you know, I swear sometimes. And you said, listen, as long as you're not shitty about, I'm paraphrasing, about women, Jews, Black people, like as long as you're not being racist or misogynist, you're not going to offend me.
Or sexist.
Or sexist, yeah. I mean, that gives me so much joy to hear. And I also wonder what it's like to be guardians of a feminist icon's legacy. That seems like a role you both take seriously. How do you think about that? And how do you think about trying to do that well?
Well, for me, it meant a re-education, okay? So the moment my mother was very sort of adamant about feminism, I wanted to know why, no? So she told me, well, look, read this book and that book and so on, no? So I did read them. And anyway, in the house, there was no women to serve men. Everybody just, you know, either wash their plates or whatever, no? And we didn't expect anybody, you know, to be in the role of the mother or in the role of the father. Everybody was collaborating in the house, no? Cleaning the house and so on, and of course, respecting women. No, and in a country where women are not respected usually, they're even murdered. So yes, we do have to have a stance there and a very precise, you know, attitude towards those horrible things that are happening in Mexico.
Yeah, and I mean, it seemed like she came from an experience in Europe and a life that was pretty misogynist and sexist as well. I mean, it's not unique to Mexico, of course.
Yes, but you know, the Surrealists were very peculiar about that because Breton had an idea that, you know, women were la femme enfant.
Yeah.
For example. So this woman child is something that I have been attacking as much as I can because I think it's the wrong way of symbolizing women. I think it's a very dangerous way of symbolizing women because they've been treated always as underdogs, no? Hmm?
Yeah, and, or product in a way.
Or just objects, you know, and this is something that always irritated Leonora very much, no? And of course, Danny and I have been always protecting, no, as much as we can, women, students, and so on and so forth. I mean, throughout our lives, no?
And I think that part of how you get to respect Leonora as well as any other sort of figure that you admire, right, is trying not to appropriate them or their voice. And that's something that's very difficult, So you have to try and let them speak for themselves. My grandmother wrote about her own life, about her own experiences. She wrote about her own ideas about certain things in terms of politics or the environment or feminism. And it's important to sort of always be able to trace back to that material for me. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest thing, is trying to make sure that her voice is her voice, right? And that happens everywhere with any sort of public figure I've found. And, you know, obviously as a family member, you want to be incredibly protective of that voice, because it was such a unique and incredible voice. It was a funny voice. It was the same voice that would whisper horrible little nothings into your ear while you were in this sort of like very proper dinner with all these business men and politicians and things like that. She just had such an incredible way about her, you know, her humor, her just way of being is something that I just want to make sure it doesn't get lost. You know, I don't want her to become a superhero. I want her to retain that incredible voice that made her her, that made us laugh, that made us think, that made us cry. You know, that's who I want to keep alive. So, you know, hopefully, you know, as we continue with her legacy, we are able to keep that alive and that isn't sort of lost. There's a lot of people that want to make her something that, you know, she may or may have not been.
She was exploring, I don't know, an internal female figure that she had to rediscover. Remember that she came from a very conventional background, no? It was a Victorian background, with my grandfather behaving like the alpha male of the household, no? Mm. And so on and so forth. So she had to rediscover this woman that had been silenced, not very successfully, I must add, no, fortunately for her. And she was always looking for what is this woman like, no? And she would search this woman through her painting, through her novels, through her interest in witches, through her interest in mythology, in Jung, no, in Carl Jung's ideas on the archetypes and so on. So she was open to a lot of things, no? She was also interested in the tarot. Incidentally, now they published a book on the tarot in England as well, no? With a magnificent deck of cards, no? So that was also a discovery, no? Mm. And she would discover things. She would rediscover and recreate things, because she was recreating herself continuously. No, this was the way of Leonora. No,
I have to go this way because you mentioned it. Can you tell us about Leonora and the witches? What did she think about it? What was that sort of creative vein like for her?
Well, first of all, she was not a witch. Now, this is something that a lot of people want to create, and it was part of what Tanya was saying, a kind of glorifying an image.
Right.
She was interested in witchcraft. She was interested in witches. But because of this interest, something opens in one, of course. Mm. Now, this opening is very mysterious. It has to do with understanding the kind of dark side of the psyche, if you want, but only as Cixous would have spoken about it. I don't know if you know about Hélène Cixous, who was a very interesting feminist writer, no? And she did speak about the witch, but it's a very particular witch. It's a witch that is there to be found and that discovers something within one. And that is the kind of witchcraft my mother was doing continuously.
Yes, I feel that deeply. So the hearing trumpet is one of my favorite. I mean, it has to be. If you've read the novel, it's one of your favorite novels. It has to be. It's so funny and so magical. And the narrator, I mean, first queering bearded woman narrator, like in history, I think, right? This idea of age turned on its head. And I see what I think I understand of some of her female friendships in it, which I love as someone whose female friendships grow, have always been so core in my life and grow more and more as I get older and grayer and have a daughter. I have this idea in my head that there was this, you know, that with Kati Horna and Remedios Varo, that there was like a circle of women, that there was like a creative life there that was somehow really exciting. Is that true in your experience? What was that really like?
Well, you see, the idea that there was some kind of guild, no? I don't think is very true. I mean, they were friends and they would speak of all sorts of things, but they did not create together, or very rarely. Kati sometimes would photograph Leonora and she would create this kind of objects, no? Mm-hmm.
Wait, and you're forgetting that Remedios and Leonora did do a play together.
Yeah, one.
Right, I'm just saying.
Yeah, you see, it was more like an accidental thing. It was more like a game than a planned activity that when they say, we're going to write something. No, it just was improvising, playing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that it's more important to me to have an idea of women being able to play like that and to have those friendships than it is to think that there was some sort of formal, like, we're a scene or something. Like, I feel like that is like not the kind of narrative that I need or relate to, or maybe that's just like a very masculine idea of the art world or something. But it's more important to me that they found friendship, that they were really able to be themselves, that they were able to make their own work, and sometimes they hung out and talked about it, that they were able to play together, and that there were men and other people in their lives and kids who were like peers and partners and friends. Like you said, she was your mother and your friend. That's magical to be able to make a community like that where there wasn't, I don't know, maybe a sense of internal oppression or.
Yeah, and I could play with her as well. I mean, the books and so on that we created together, no? Huh? Yeah. Was that kind of play. So no, it was not like André Breton, who, as the great pope of surrealism, no,
right,
would have this very intellectual discussions or whatever. They were important, of course. I mean, I must admit that they were. After all, they changed the way art was conceived, no? Mm. But no, this was not at all what Leonora would do in Mexico, no? It was more playful than serious conceptual, you know, meditations on this subject or that one.
Mm-hmm.
Mm?
Right, which is such a more generative place to be in and so much less self-important, I think, like so much less grandiose. Did you meet Kati Horna and Remedios Varo? Were they around in your childhood?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Kati, I would visit very often, and Remedios as well, because they were very near. They were living near the house. So, but also Alice Raon, and also, I don't know, a lot of people. Leon Orfini, when we were in France, mm-hmm. no? And a lot of other people. But I mean, the thing is that since Remedios was living nearby, and since Kati was living nearby, yes, I had a closer contact with them, no? Mm-hmm. And especially with Remedios' cats. They were extremely intelligent and very thoughtful, and they had very interesting ideas, no?
You talk about cats the way that she does the hairy trumpet.
Yeah, of course. Well, cats have always been very important, both for Danny and for me, no?
I would love to know more about what it's like managing the material. You've shared so many images, and I find you such a wonderful job of giving so much context to how much art she created. You've really cast a light on how much creative work there was, which is so exciting. It really takes it out of these five paintings that you see in so many like blog posts or whatever, but you see this huge, huge visionary landscape of her work. Practically, what's that like for you? Are you digging through boxes of art, or how does that work of the foundation happen?
Basically, we wanted to archive a lot of things, so we started with a lot of the sort of books and things that weren't as sort of flashy, maybe. But out of that, we start to realize, okay, we actually need a proper digital archive. And very slowly, with the collaboration of several of the institutions that we were working with for exhibitions, as well as books and other things, we were able to sort of slowly start to collect a digital archive that had a high enough resolution where people could actually appreciate the little details of her artwork. And once I was able to start collecting that with the arduous help of not just me, but also my father and my mother. It's been a very sort of small team that keeps working very hard to continue this project and building it. Being able to just share it, and it sort of evolved from just sharing an image to then being like, well, am I really giving it enough credit? Like, the might be weird thing to do when I see one of Leo's paintings when I'm back home is to just get lost in the details. Because she was such a genius with those little details. Yeah. There's so many Easter eggs thrown inside of a painting. There's, you know, even humor inside of many of them. And being able to find those little details and rediscover them, I think, has been incredible for me, because it really makes me feel like she's still alive, you know, and that is one of the most beautiful things I can get. And I feel like my father went through the same thing and that was why I was egging him on to write that memoir. It wasn't so much because we were thinking about selling it. I was like, you do that for you. That has to be a personal project. And I think that so many incredible memories and things came out of that experience for him as well as me reading it, that, you know, it's a valuable thing that I think everybody should do, you know. If you have somebody in your life that really impacted you like that, and they've passed away, or they're still here, it doesn't matter. I think it's important to do that kind of a project, because then they will be here forever. Mm-hmm. You will have them there for generations, and you will continue to remember new things, and that's a beautiful thing.
Were there things you learned about her, or that like struck you in a new way from the process of writing that memoir?
Oh, incidentally, it's this one was
The Invisible Painting. It's a beautiful cover.
Thank you. Again, please, I got sort of sidetracked.
That's all right. I was thinking, like, were there things that you learned about her, or that made you think about her in a new way in the process of writing that memoir?
Yes, well, you see, the thing is that mostly people would speak about anecdotes, no? And how funny she was, or how strange he was, or how surrealist she was, and so on and so forth. And they didn't speak about her art.
Right.
I was so puzzled about that. I said, well, how can you write about an artist without mentioning her art? How did she do things? How did she make sculptures? How did she paint? How did she, etc.? No, she was a medieval woman in that sense, no? That she would touch upon so many things, no? Right. She would go into writing, she'd go into painting, she'd go into puppet making. She would do so, she would experiment with so many materials, no? And that's what is so interesting about her, that she had this capacity of imagining with her fingers or imagining with the paintbrush or imagining in the knitting, because she liked sewing things, no? And that's how she made her puppets, no? And her dolls.
Oh yeah, so this is something that I wonder about. How does a person give themselves the confidence and permission to create in that way? Like, where do you think that came from her, to just continuously play and make art and, like you say, think through her fingers?
Well, breaking rules. I think rules are there to be disobeyed. No? And if you obey rules, then you become sort of maimed. No? You're stunted. And Leonora was not going to allow that, no? Especially not in her art. So she experimented in all sorts of things because she wanted to see how her art defined her, not how she defined her art. Mm. If that makes any sense.
Talk more about that, how her art defined her. I love that.
Well, you see, the thing is that when she was, for example, making a doll, she could only find the doll as it appeared. No? So the moment that the doll appeared, she was able to create the doll.
Did she feel like that about painting as well?
Yes, well, painting came from visions, so it's something else. It has another substance, no? They're different. Dolls have a kind of materiality, no? Mm-hmm. And they appear. And paintings are more like visions.
Mm-hmm.
They have this ghostly spectral substance to it, no? Or to them. She very adamantly said that her paintings did not come from dreams. Visions are different from dreams, no? Mm-hmm. Visions either come or don't. You know, dreams are there even if we don't remember them, no?
And did she have like a practice, a spiritual practice or a meditative practice that was a part of her calling forth those visions?
Well, yes, but I suppose that she created her own way to meditate, because she would follow certain techniques of meditation, such as the Buddhist or the Tibetan and so on. That's true. But it's not through following a technique of meditation that you would find those visions. Visions are a bit, are whimsical. They come when they want. It's like cats. Cats come when they want, not when you call them and you say, well, come here. No, it's not a dog at all, no? And art is not like a dog that you call it and it comes. No, you know.
Did she work differently when she was painting than if she was making dolls or sculpting? Or was the house different? Was she affected by that practice differently?
Well, yes. For example, if she was going to, make a sculpture, if she was going to create a sculpture, it had to be in a place where she was able to do that, no? For example, where she could play with plasticine and create that object in plasticine, then it went through the whole process now of, you know, the pouring of the iron and so on into a special kind of mold and so on and so forth. No, but that was not what that there she did not participate in that. She would only participate in the model, in the plasticine model, for example. No, now if she was making a doll, it was something else. That was far more a kind of knitting process, if you see my point. And it was far more intimate, as painting was also intimate, but that she had a little studio for that, no? But what is interesting about Leonora's studio is that her studio was covered with plants that were growing from here and there. It was completely disordered. It was not the kind of studio that Diego Rivera had, which was huge and, you know, majestic. No, nothing of that sort. No, her studio was always sort of improvised, small, cluttered. No,
far more half empty bottles of tequila in drawers than Rivera's, I'll assure you.
Yeah, well, that and maybe little, you know, stoves where she would heat her coffee, but also wax in order to arrange a certain kind of mixture, no, to either paint or to cover an object and so on and so forth. No?
One thing we think about a lot with this, with our work, I have a co-producer for the podcast and co-author. She's not here right now, Amy, but we're always interested in trying to find the women in the story, right? Because of exactly what you described, that when writing about an art movement, you'll get all of these men and then like, and a woman was there too, and like a funny anecdote about what the woman did. But we find it, I guess male writers, but also women writers in the media and stuff, seem to find it hard to really take seriously women's work. And I think sometimes the ideas are more complicated. They're a bit weirder. Women artists seem to not so explicitly try to reference a famous male voice that came before and put their next step with the next head of the monument or something, that they're doing something that's so internal and so alchemical that it can be really hard to figure out how to talk about how it fits in this sort of stacking of monuments. How do you think we do a good job of writing, if we're going to write about Leonora? And I'm going to take your piece from before, Daniel, for sure, to stay anchored in her words. She gave us a lot. But in terms of writing about her art, how do we do a good job of writing about that, do you think?
Through feeling. More than intellectualizing, no? Because the intellect is always a kind of judge. To intellectualize something, you have to judge something. To feel, either you feel or you don't feel.
I'll take that.
There's also something very interesting about creativity, because creativity is, in essence, what the establishment, whatever way you want to describe that, fears. Because it imagines a different world. It imagines different things that are not the way they are right now. That's very dangerous for many people. And I think that being able to understand how important creativity is and trying to, you see, everybody would always ask Leo, what is that painting? And she hated that. Right. She would always throw it back to you and ask you what you saw. Because you see, it's much more important for her that you become involved in the creative process yourself and understand the importance and value of that creativity and continue to strengthen it, because it's like a muscle, right? Because that is truly what can change things. And I still truly believe that that is the most valuable thing we can harness in ourselves, is that creativity. particularly if one wants to change things, because one doesn't appreciate the patriarchal neoliberal capitalist society we have to live in, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we're in like a dystopian environmental nightmare of capitalist patriarchy. It's pretty hard just to keep our chins up, let alone like make art, you know, but I agree with you. And I love the way you said it's like a muscle, like it's not something that we just do to relax. It's like something that we do to be strong also.
I have some questions about her paintings. I was struck by the bed imagery in her later work and some of her quotes about how she was afraid of death, and as family members, how you saw her deal with that and how that symbolism, like what that meant to her, because I know the bed in Frida Kahlo's work is very symbolic as well. Second part of my question, or separate second question, is I love her focal point in her paintings. Most of them are kind of spread out. It's not like this. A lot of times artists, they want your eye to be drawn in a very specific way. And she was just like, hell no, you can kind of go wherever you want. Was that intentional? Did she ever speak about that?
The thing is this, that there are no symbols unless you want to find symbols in the painting. The painting is already telling you something, but you won't find those symbols outside. You won't say, she was influenced by the Celts, or she was influenced by pre-Hispanic imagery, and so on and so forth. So that's false. I mean, the thing is, naturally, all these things come together in the person, no? But the painting itself is creating its own symbolic self, if you get my point, no? So that's why it's so difficult to interpret Leonora, no? Because the idea behind the painting is that it can speak to you, as Danny was saying. It will tell you something if you're open to hear it. It will make you feel something if you're open to feeling. But if you have a preconceived idea on what Leonora was, no, then it's impossible to go through the threshold. Okay? Impossible to go through that kind of threshold unless you're willing to risk something. And risking is coming in naked, okay? And being able to be affected by what you see and what you hear and what you smell, as well as the kind of animal you're going to find. If you're not in contact with your own inner animal, Leonora's animals have no meaning.
And in terms of how she was afraid of death, yes, I think that that's something that will essentially, you know, as you get closer to that age, it becomes something that's more present. It's not something that stopped her from living in any way or manner, but it was something she was honest about. And I think that a lot of the time, all of the time, death in our lives is not, unless it's immediately present, it's something we're ignoring. So being honest about that fear, I think, is incredibly powerful, not only throughout her, I mean, and you can see it through that writing, but then when it was her time, I mean, you know, unfortunately, we all get the same things, right? We all start hallucinating. There's this process that we go through when one's dying. And I think that, did she prepare herself like through her life to get to that stage and be able to appreciate it and not fear it? Yes. I think that she was even at that stage where your body is doing the things that it's going to do when it's giving up, I could still see an inner peace. And even, you know, when you're not afraid of those hallucinations and you can even like enjoy them, I mean, that in and of itself tells you so much about the knowledge of the person. And it made me admire her even more, seeing how she handled her own death. I hope I get to not only live my death as well as her, but also my old age, because that was something that was very important to her. Being able to also live in your own skin and live all these different moments of life. And I hope that I also get to be as gracious of a whole person as she was. You know, there's a lot of lessons spread around for one.
And then there's another thing that what was extremely interesting about this idea about death and so on is that she explored death in her novels mainly, not in her paintings, curiously enough. Huh? It was her novels, and then it was in The Hearing Trumpet, and then it was if she wanted to explore something in her deep self, then she would go into writing. And it was writing the media that would take her through that, I don't know, venue. Hmm?
And that probably goes back to being able to deal with all the trauma that she experienced through writing down below. You know, I think it's...
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what an early, super brave act to like, to tell it all. To live it all again in the telling of it, and to sort of, I don't know if she had faith that that would lead her through, but it seemed like she knew that that would be therapeutic. Seems like a kind of a lame word for it, but that she knew that it would help her transmute it or something.
Well, it was a kind of exorcism in a way. That's because those are devils, no? Those states of mind are devils and they have to be exorcised, no? That part of the, you know, of the dark, dangerous side of oneself can be exorcised through paintings, through writings, through all sorts of other, you know, ways of dealing with this. And she dealt with all this very traumatic past by doing things to herself and her art. No? Her art helped her in that.
How do you think she thought about madness?
Well, she was not as enthusiastic as Breton was, because she had to endure, no? Other people calling her mad, and she had to suffer, you know, she was inflicted upon. They gave her a drug called cardiazol that was extremely dangerous, and electroshocks and so on and so forth. So no, it's not amusing. No, it was not the kind of strange, magical, and so on and so forth moment that Breton's speaking about in Nadja, no?
Do you think that she was conscious of trying to navigate her own mental health throughout the rest of her life? Like, was she actively engaging with art to stay balanced in her mental world?
Well, mental and physical, no? Because yes, of course, art was much more than quote unquote a creative activity, no? It was a restorative activity and a renewal. So she also felt that when she was painting, no?
And there's also a historical component behind this word madness, right? And even how it sort of was used to criminalize those that lived differently than us, those that had different sexual orientations. I mean, this was weaponized, and to a certain degree still is, unfortunately, in many places, right? So I think one also needs to understand the structures of power behind these categorizations.
Yeah, and there's always the kind of idea that artists have to be mad, no? In order to be creative. Or in order to be creative, you have to have something wrong in you, no? There's an anomaly in one. And this is bullshit. No? This is real bullshit. Why? Because it's something that happened to her as far as the war. You know, the war has an impact. Oh, yes, great discovery. You know, right. It might even, you know, I don't know, create a mental imbalance. God, how intelligent that is.
Right.
Of course. She suffered the war. She suffered the war internally as well as externally. That's what wars are like, no?
Yeah. It's interesting to see people reclaiming the word madness now. I do think, like, in the same way that we've interviewed a lot of people about neurodivergence or neurodiversity, like, who gets categorized as divergent? Who gets categorized as anomalous? And that, you also remind me of Sula, that novel by Toni Morrison. There's a piece at the end where she talks about how Sula was like an artist who didn't get to make art. And so she kind of didn't get to be a complete person because she never got to have an art practice. I'm glad that Leonora got to make art and is such a light for all of us in holding on to our creativity, especially in these times. What do you think she thought happened after we die?
Well, you know, what's interesting about your question is that when Leonora was dying, I was reading to her the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Remember how she would go on and on about string theory? And I mean, it was so interesting because somebody that, you know, it technically didn't pass middle school, yet could manage and handle the most complicated scientific thoughts, you know, or ideas we had at the time, and she could explain it perfectly to you. She was just so curious, and I think that never, hopefully, you know, one has that forever, right? That curiosity to keep searching and learning and discovering. That's part of the play, right?
Yeah, and she was interested, for example, in the Gurdjieff group. And she was interested in Buddhism, and she was interested in the Bible as well. There were many, many, many things, and the White Goddess, and many other entities that would somehow open doors. So if they opened the door for her, she would go through it. She would try and see what was behind it, no?
Mm-hmm.
Even one of her novels, which is called The Stone Door, no, is in many ways that, no, the way that she entered different dimensions, that I hope that we're going to be able to publish it soon, so that people can see what she did with this kind of inner world, or how she crossed this very daunting territories of mind.
What do you think we should carry from Leonora today, 2022?
Her non-definition, so that you can define yourself, no? However you want, in a state of absolute liberty. No? The liberty that you give yourself, not that the liberty that is given by others.
I'm going to work on my muscle of disobedience and creativity too.
I think that's a very useful thing to do.
Yeah, I think for me, it's always been two things, right? The respect for nature. So from every plant, insect, and animal that you cross, making sure that you treat them as equals. And the importance of creativity for resistance. And nowadays, I think that in a world that seems to try to spiral back into fascism and militarism, I think it's very important to fight back with creativity.
For the sake of every plant and animal and insect as an equal, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
So do I.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else you wanted to make sure that we heard or that we shared?
Read her books. Go and watch her paintings.
And you can also follow us on Instagram so you don't have to break into people's private collections, because some of those are unfortunately not in public viewing, but we're trying to make sure that her art is still viewable for free. So you can follow us at Leonora Carrington Estate. And I would also highly recommend My Father's Memoir. It's a very beautifully written book, very personal, a ton of incredible memoirs, as well as things that have never been seen or published. So it's a work of love, and that is a beautiful thing to be able to share.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for bringing it into the world. I think there are women, you know, so many women alive today who can feel so empowered by what Leonora left us.
My name is Jessica, and I just wanted to say last summer I was in Guadalajara, and I was so excited to come across an exhibit there in Guadalajara of Leonora's sculptures. I just kept staring and taking them all in from every angle, and it was a beautiful experience.
I'm sorry to disappoint, but those are not Leonora's.
Oh, no. What do you mean?
Did you go to Tequila, to the Jalisco? Town of Tequila, Jalisco?
No, it wasn't. It was I feel like it was at the university there in Guadalajara. No.
They're not Leonora's.
Yeah, been having a lot of issues with reproductions, unauthorized reproductions. Wow. I know, it's unfortunately part of the art world that we have to deal with. But there is a beautiful collection if you're back in Guadalajara next time in Tequila. And they have these incredible sculptures that they were able to collect pretty much the entire collection of Leonora's legit sculptures. And they're beautifully exhibited.
Yeah, I'm going back to Mexico in January. So I will make sure to go.
I'm so sorry. What a heartbreak.
I know. Oh my gosh. Well, you know, there's also no Santa Claus. So
right. I mean, and so are they reproductions? They're unauthorized reproductions that people are exhibiting?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So you saw like a ghost or a shadow of her real statues. How are they reproducing them?
Well, with very bad faith.
I see.
Unfortunately, there's not a lot of, I mean, I do literally research on justice in Mexico, and there's no justice for human beings. You can assure yourself the copyrights are also not doing very well, unfortunately. So, yeah, it's been very hard for us, but it's part of the work that we do is making sure that exhibits do happen with her actual work and people can actually see her real stuff.
What a privilege to meet you both. Thank you
Thank you, too. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for having us. We really appreciate everybody joining us and helping us share Leo and her story.
It's a thrill and a privilege. We can't wait to share this episode and continue to read her books and stare into the abyss of ourselves that is her art. And I appreciate so much the content that you've given us. I'm so excited to dig back into her work with that grounding and that context. I appreciate it so much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
As we often say at the end of this podcast, blessed fucking be.
Good, good. Bye, good, bye.
Bye. You must be a witch. The Images podcast is created by Risa Dickens and Amy Torok, with insight and support from the Coven at patreon.com/missingwitches.
Amy and Risa are the co-authors of Missing Witches, Reclaiming True Histories of Feminist Magic, which is available now wherever you get your books or audiobooks, and of New Moon Magic, 13 Anti-Capitalist Tools for Resistance and Reenchantment, coming fall 2023.